Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. In this episode, Tamara Payne talks with MSNBC host of The Readout, Joy Ann Reid, about her book Medgar and Merle, Medgar Evers and the Love Story That Awakened America, published by Mariner Books in February 2024. This interview was recorded on March 18th, 2024 via Zoom.
I want to tell you that I really enjoyed reading your book. Thank you for doing this on such an important couple, Medgar and Merle Evers. As you know, I've also worked on a book with my father about Malcolm X. So Medgar Evers came up a lot in our work because he was on the ground in Mississippi. You referenced James Baldwin talking about Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King were the core triumvirate of the civil rights movement because they were troublemakers. But also since their assassinations, Medgar Evers' work and his legacy has been overshadowed by the events that followed his assassination and other events that happened in the civil rights movement. So I'd like you to give us a reminder of who Medgar Evers is and his importance.
Well, thank you so much, first of all, again, Tamara, for having me here. But yeah, you know, James Baldwin, and to me, he was the greatest of our American writers. And so when he says it, I believe it. And he did call Medgar, Malcolm, and Martin the great triumvirate of the civil rights movement. And I think it's because of the nature of the work that they were doing and the dangers each of them faced that were unique. So for Medgar Evers, the danger that he faced that was unique was Mississippi. Mississippi kind of stands alone and stands apart in American history as the most dangerous place to be Black, really in the history of the United States. And it's because Mississippi was actually the wealthiest American state in terms of the dominance of its cotton industry, not just in the United States, but worldwide. It also had such a huge cotton economy that it imported the largest percentage of Africans into its territory, meaning that at the end of the Civil War, it had a majority Black population. So ironically, it also had the most successful Reconstruction, that precious 12 years when we were a multiracial democracy. And it was also the state that put down Reconstruction with the greatest viciousness, in that its Ku Klux Klan was the most bold and audacious, in that it was not afraid to kill Northern boys like Emmett Till and white people like Goodman and Schwerner. And they also killed a young Mr. Cheney, who was, yes, a local young Black man. And so this was the unique environment that Medgar Evers was operating in when he became the first field secretary that the NAACP placed in the state of Mississippi. And they did that in part because he was an activist who was already growing in renown as an NAACP man. He was a member, and he was also in his comportment, somebody who was pushing to register to vote along with his brother and other World War II veterans. So he had a boldness and audaciousness. And he also had applied to Ole Miss because he really wanted to be Thurgood Marshall. He wanted to go to law school. And rather than finish that application, which was actually rejected by the state of Mississippi upon him doing his interview to get in, the NAACP in New York said, you know what, we have a better idea. Instead of pushing to integrate Ole Miss, why don't you come work for us? And his very first case really was the investigation of the Emmett Till case, which made that case a case that went to court, because normally lynchings of that sort never even went to court. And it was because of him, it not just went to court, but actually there was a trial. And we know how the trial ended, but Medgar Evers was the man who made that possible.
Yes, by actually being there and on the field and also having the connections with the community, it's so important. As a field secretary, what really was that work like?
So the main job of the field secretary was to investigate murders of Black people, lynchings across the state, and to write reports about those lynchings to send back to the Home Office to bolster one of the things the NAACP was doing, which was to try to get anti-lynching laws passed at a federal level. And so he's building that case by investigating those lynchings. The other job of the field secretary of the NAACP was to register people to vote, to encourage African Americans to take advantage of their 15th Amendment right to register to vote. There was no enabling legislation, as we've heard from the Supreme Court conservative majority. They said that that is needed in order to make constitutional amendments have force. There was no enabling legislation. There was no Voting Rights Act at that time. So getting people to register to vote was dangerous and difficult, and people were being terrorized out of registering to vote. Registering to vote could get your job pulled. You could be fired for registering to vote as a Black person in Mississippi. You could be evicted from the property where you worked as a sharecropper, or you could have your mortgage pulled by the white citizens councils that were enacted after Brown v. Board and the resistance to desegregation. You could be lynched for trying to register to vote. And many people were killed, shot and killed for registering themselves and others to vote. You could be thrown in jail. So that was job number two. And job number three, of course, was trying to get more people to become members of the NAACP. So those were his three jobs. And the second two were damn near impossible in the state of Mississippi, which was, for all intents and purposes, a white terrorist state.
And what happens also, what you write about in this book, is that being in Mississippi and also understanding how to get people interested, registered to vote, he was also trying to appeal to them to understand how they can build up better relations in Mississippi, correct?
Well, what he was trying to do was to get Mississippians who, again, were living in an apartheid state and were terrorized by not just the Klan, but the suited version of the Klan, the White Citizens Councils, and unbeknownst to them by a spy organization called the Sovereignty Commission, which operated at the state level, overseen by the governor, which was spying on them constantly, which even had Black clergy and Black newspaper men spying on them, publishing your name if you joined the NAACP in newspapers so that you could be terrorized and targeted by the Klan, outing people who were registering people to vote and setting them up to be killed. And so this was the constant state of terror. And so his ability to register people to vote was almost nil. Mississippi had the lowest Black voter registration in the entire country at about less than 6%. And most people didn't register, not because they didn't have a sense of civic responsibility, but because they were too afraid. And as he tried to explain to his bosses in New York that his failure to register voters was not because of a lack of civics in the state of Mississippi, but because people were too scared, they didn't believe or listen to him. And what he was trying to explain to them is, before we can get people to register to vote or to join the NAACP, which again could also get you fired or your life destroyed, first you had to develop a basic sense of courage. And what he saw was that the teachers and the sort of people who made up the middle class, who were mainly teachers or people who were the small number of physicians or people who worked in the mortuary industry, that was the Black middle class. They were too afraid to lose their homes or to lose their mortgages or to go up against white society. It was their kids who were brave enough to stand up to the fascists that were running the state. It was the kids who were willing to sit in, who were willing to march, who were willing to, you know, have boycotts against the stores and shops and the libraries and zoos and other places where they weren't allowed to go. And he said that that was the courage that needed to be developed so that Mississippians could save themselves. But his bosses disagreed. They were very much against marches and boycotts and civic resistance in the streets. But Megger understood that was the only way to save Mississippians. It was the only way they could save themselves, that court rulings were not going to save them. That wasn't going to be enough, because white Mississippi just ignored the rulings. And this was a fundamental tension between Medgar Evers and the people he worked for, who just didn't want to keep paying the bail money for these teenagers who were sitting in at the library, who were sitting in at Woolworths, who were marching in downtown Jackson, Mississippi. They didn't want that done. They wanted that to stop. And the other people who wanted that to stop was the Kennedy administration, which was fighting a Cold War in which the marches and civic resistance were playing out on television around the world and making America look less like the democracy it says it was and more like a police state. So there was all this tension in the job he was doing, where he wasn't getting support from the people he worked for, and he also couldn't get support among the people he was trying to rouse to register to vote and to join the NAACP because they were just too afraid. So he lived in between those two tensions. And then the third tension, of course, were the outside civil rights groups that were coming in. The groups like CORE, who were now doing bus trips into Mississippi from the north, carrying northern activists in. And in a way, he felt, well, that is doubling the efforts I'm already doing, and they're not going to be any more successful than I was. So he lived in between the tensions between those three groups.
But now I want to pull a little bit back, because what I was reading in your book is that you really wrote this as a love story between Medgar and Murley. And I want to bring her into now, and how do they meet? And she's married to him. They have children. and she's facing this with him. So I kind of want to pull back a little bit and just talk about how they met and then bring us back into, you know, where they are here.
Absolutely. Well, we did a lot of like deep dives into the histories of these two families, the Everses and Merle, the Beasleys. Both of them are Mississippi natives that go all the way back to enslavement in the state of Mississippi. While Medgar is this feisty guy from a feisty family that in their own way really stood up to the white rulers of the state in small ways and large, Merle, her family was different. She came from a family of educators, her grandmother, who she called Mama, and her aunt, who's also named Merle. Aunt Merle raised her after her grandma took her from her 16-year-old mom because she understood that her son, the Mama, who her son was the father of Merle, she understood that he was not going to stick around enough to be a good father and that this teenager wasn't going to be capable of being a single mother. She took Merle in, named her Merle, and raised her. And they raised Merle to be a very, let's just say, upscale girl in a downscale world. She was a very talented piano player who they would hype her up and say, "You're so good, little sister," is what they called her. "Little sister, you're so great at the piano. One day you're going to play Carnegie Hall." And they just hyped her up even as a Black girl in segregated Mississippi. She also was being raised to be an educator herself. She was told the most important thing was her education and her dignity. They also warned her that when they sent her off at age 17 to college, to Alcorn College, that she was to stay away from three kinds of men: upperclassmen, football players, and those darn World War II veterans, because they were just too worldly. And of course, Medgar Evers was all three. So of course, she fell madly in love with him on day one of her sojourn at Alcorn State, fell madly in love with him. And then there was this sort of intellectual pursuit because he viewed her as a bit too young at 17, and he was 25 and home from World War II. But they had this intellectual courtship where she was trying to bring herself up to his level. He'd seen the world. He was obsessed with the, you know, liberation movements on the continent of Africa. And she wanted to be able to have conversations with him. So she was studying up and trying to get to his level. And so they had this intellectual conversational courtship in which he pretended to love the classical music that she was playing. And she pretended to know more than she really did about Kenya. And that's how it started. And once they were able to convince her grandma and her aunt that they should be married, they were married in 1952. She dropped out of Alcorn and set off on this journey that she thought was going to be becoming a 1950s housewife to an insurance salesman, only to find out that he was selling liberation with insurance as he was going out into the Mississippi Delta selling insurance policies for T.R.M. Howard's Magnolia Insurance Company. And T.R.M. Howard is his own character. He was a Renaissance man, Black, wealthy Mississippian who ran this insurance company, but also a clinic, and basically ran this little town of Mound Bayou, Mississippi, where they moved. So they had this relationship that was part tension. For her, it was all fear, constant fear, and him selling revolution, liberation, along with insurance, and then later becoming the NAACP field secretary. She knew that would mean that he wasn't going to live long. And she was trying to get every day with her man and just trying to have him stay home and raise their kids and be with her. And he was not about that life. He was constantly telling her, number one, "I'm going to do this because I'm doing this for you and the kids so that you will have a life and a state that is worthy of you. And that I'm not, you know, a martyr." But he understood that even if it meant his life, he was not going to stop. And so that was part of the tension in their marriage throughout.
How long do you think it took or her to come along to really kind of understand what he meant by, "I'm doing this for you and the kids. I want our children to grow up in a better Mississippi"?
They had, you know, an 11-year, it was just 11 tumultuous years that they were together. And it's amazing when you think about the fact that Miss Merle turned 91 years young yesterday. I spoke with her and her surviving children on the phone. We FaceTimed because it was her birthday yesterday. She was only married to Megan for 11 years. And they were very difficult years. And throughout, I would say the first 10 of them, she fought it every step of the way. She fought it when he first said he wanted to apply to go to Ole Miss Law School because she knew he would be killed. They lived at the top of the Klan's death list for all of their marriage. She feared every time he went out the door that he would not come back. And she argued with him all throughout when he tried to put their kids on the list of students who would desegregate Jackson schools. She was an absolute no on that. you know, down to him wanting to name their oldest son Kenyatta. And she was like, how is a boy named Kenyatta even going to survive in the state of Mississippi in the 1950s? Are you out of your mind? And so Kenyatta became his middle name. And this, despite the fact that for a while, she was his secretary. She was his secretary at Magnolia Mutual. And she was his secretary at first at the NAACP before she had her third child and became a stay-at-home mom. I think in 1963, there was a sea change in her attitude as well, because she realized not only did she deeply respect this man and the mission that he had, but she got mad in part at the NAACP because she felt that they weren't protecting him enough. And so she was protective of him. She was his protector because they weren't giving him physical protection to the home. And then their house was firebombed a few weeks before his actual assassination. And that made her even madder. And she realized she had this protective instinct that also made her realize that this was not his mission. This was their mission. If they firebombed that house, they weren't going to just kill him. They were going to kill her and the kids too. And I think she developed a sense of resoluteness in the year 1963, which is also the year James Baldwin met Medgar Evers and came to respect and love him. I think that year was momentous for her in a very deep way because she realized that no one else was going to protect this man like she was, and that that mission was something that they needed to share.
Yeah, no, that's so important to understand this. I'm just really curious about how that really came about. And then I want to talk to you a little bit more about how you did the research on this book. Can you go into your process?
Yeah, absolutely. The interviews were crucial. I did about half a dozen interviews with Miss Murley, mostly on the phone. And then at one point we flew out to California and her youngest son, Van, brought her to his house and we hung out with them for a full day. My sister, my husband, myself. And we hung up with her and her niece who does her makeup. We filmed the interview because we wanted to have it for posterity. And it was just an amazing, amazing opportunity. In addition to that, the Evers family gave us extensive access to their archives at the Evers Institute in Jackson. So we went down with our team of researchers. I actually brought on two researchers. I hired two researchers from the great Howard University who assisted me every step of the way. Cameron Nelson and Angela Pashayan, who did a fantastic job. Sean Pruitt, who is my ride or die personal assistant, who's also an incredible amateur genealogist in her own right. She was an ad hoc additional researcher on the book. And so the bunch of us just went down to Jackson and we spent a bunch of time, not just in the archives, but interviewing the people who knew the Evers best, their neighbors, the Sweets who lived down the street, Miss Joe, who lived across the street, who has since passed, the great Miss Joe, and the family who lived next door, the daughter who was a witness to the assassination. And then I just read a bunch. Charles Evers wrote a really great biography. Miss Murley, who herself wrote two great biographies and participated with Manning Marable in consolidating Medgar's papers, which was another book that I read through. We convened with a gentleman named Mr. Mitchell, who was the journalist who uncovered the crucial information that reopened the case. I read his book and just, you know, I'm a reader. You can see from my, you can't see, but those of you who can see what's behind me as we're talking together on Zoom can see I'm in a room full of books. And so I did a lot of reading and a lot of research. And then we also went deep into ancestry.com and just started going through the genealogy and figuring out who these people were. We also talked with historians about the state of Mississippi and its cotton industry. We even went and stood outside Parchman Penitentiary and didn't get in, but we did a lot of research on that. And then I talked to and interviewed a lot of the people who at the time were young teenagers who followed Medgar and who became either activists in their own right or who lived through that movement. So it was a lot of interviews. It was a lot of time spent in the Mississippi Delta. We went to Mound Bayou and went through the museum where they keep all of the information about T.R.M. Howard, et cetera. So we spent time. It took about 2 years to get all of the research done. And then I got on a plane and I flew to Paris and I went into an Airbnb and started writing. And I got 7 out of the 11 chapters written while I was there. And I did my James Baldwin, honey. The first day before I even started writing, I went on a tour. There's a Black woman who does a tour of all of the places James Baldwin went. And I ate where he ate and I sat where he sat. And I tried to take in his energy to try to get this book written.
Oh, wonderful. How long did it take?
The whole process was about 2 years and it was grueling. I have to be honest, because I was doing that while full-time doing my show, The Readout. And it's interesting because I actually got the show in 2020 in the midst of the pandemic and then decided to do this book in 2021 is when I sat down with my publisher and my agent and decided this is what I wanted to do. And so 2021 and 2022, it was difficult because it was still, the pandemic was not over. And so we were trying to balance, you know, the pandemic issues and travel issues. And so from 2021 and 2022, we just really, really dug in. And also for much of 2023. So it was like 2.5 years of work.
The way that you also recount how the Medgar murder was, case was reopened and they were finally able to get justice. What was interesting to me also with that is the timing, right? Because Byron Dillard Beckwith was brought to trial back in the 1960s when, you know, it happened June 1963 and they had a trial. But at that time, the people who were defending him, and also, as you even brought out, and this is also, I guess, through the reporting of Jerry Mitchell, that the Sovereign Committee was the spy organization who had been interviewing people, let's say, in a nice way, to make sure they were on the right side of this story, making sure that Byron would get off with this murder. And I just found it really fascinating how this story came to be. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, Byron Dillard Beckwith, it was one of the fastest FBI investigations ever, which was odd in and of itself, because normally they somehow couldn't seem to solve the murders of Black folks in the state of Mississippi. But because Medgar Evers was such a high profile assassination, J. Edgar Hoover himself got involved. And Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who was the attorney general at the time, vowed that they were going to catch the murderers at the time, because a lot of witnesses said they saw three people running from the scene. But we'll leave that there. We're actually, my husband and I, Jason, are working on a documentary about the assassination itself. So stay tuned for that, because we dig more into some of the unanswered questions about the assassination. But once Byron Dillard Beckwith was identified, he was very bold and very confident that he would be acquitted, because that is the way the law worked in the United States and in the South. It was essentially legal to kill Black people back then, really up until maybe the 1970s. You didn't see white men convicted of killing Black people anywhere in the South. Keeping Black people from being able to vote is the way that the fascist South got away from the 15th Amendment, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which were supposed to give particularly Black men the right to vote. But if you couldn't vote, you couldn't get on a jury, because the way you get in jury service is you register to vote. So if you don't let Blacks register to vote, they can't be on juries. Women were not allowed to serve on juries, women of any race, until 1968 in the state of Mississippi. So Byron Dillard Beckwith was guaranteed a jury of all white men, as were the killers of Emmett Till. So he knew he would get off. But just to have extra insurance, the Sovereignty Commission, which was formed after the Brown v. Board decision, Supreme Court decision in 1954, to ensure massive resistance against integration. The Sovereignty Commission was actually, as you said, interviewing jurors to make sure they got the right kind of jury in 1963, that they would rule the right way. And they were also helping Byron Dillard Beckwith's defense behind the scenes. Jerry Mitchell brought that out 30 years later. He discovered that they were assisting in the defense. The White Citizens Council paid for Byron Dillard Beckwith's defense attorney. So he got the three top defense lawyers in the state to work for free on his case. The state paid their bills rather than him. So, of course, he goes to trial in 1963. But what even all of these diabolical machinations didn't take into account was that something was changing in the 1960s besides race, education. On that jury in 1963 were a couple of college educated white men. And probably due to their presence, that jury hung, which is not the way it was supposed to go. He was supposed to be acquitted in 10 minutes, like the jury in the Emmett Till case was. Instead, the jury hung. So the state of Mississippi, because again, this was a nationally known figure at the time, his assassination touched off marches and protests throughout the United States, as far away as Philadelphia and Maine. And so they were like, we got to try this guy again. They tried him again in 1964. Same thing happens. Another jury with some college-educated white men on it. The jury hangs again. The state of Mississippi and the Hinds County DA decided not to try the case again. But they also did some sloppy Mississippi things. They lost track of the gun. The gun suddenly disappears, oddly enough, into the hands of a former judge. The transcripts disappear. They don't keep them. What they didn't know is that Merle Evers had a copy of the transcripts and never let them go. That comes back up again in the story. And they also let go of the evidence. But Byron Dillard Beckwith, he never stops talking about and bragging about killing Medgar Evers. He boasts about it, and he's so boastful about it, he actually tries to run for governor of Mississippi, thinking himself a hero of the American South. And so 30 years later, when the Hinds County DA is convinced to reopen the case by Merle Evers Williams and by Jerry Mitchell, they've got a lot of data. They've got the transcripts because Merle had them. They've got Byron Dillard Beckwith's braggadocio. And through a really interesting turn of events, which I'll leave people to read in the book, they get the gun. And then this man, Byron Della Beckwith, is ultimately convicted 30 years later in 1994 of the assassination of Medgar Evers. And for Merle Evers Williams, this was her mission for 30 years to make sure it happened. It happened. She was in the courtroom, and her eldest son, who is one of the people that he sort of took my heart most in the book, Daryl Kenyatta Evers, was in the courtroom. And he said to the media afterwards, he was there because he wanted that killer to see the ghost of Medgar Evers in him, because he looked remarkably like his father.
And it goes to show you her tenaciousness and never giving up seeking justice in this. But also, I want to talk even more about her spirit after Medgar Evers is assassinated and she goes on to become an exemplary widow. I'm sure that's not what was in her cards, what she wanted to do. But also, you know, her relationship even with the other widows, Martin Luther King, Coretta Scott King, and Dr. Betty Shabazz, and the special relationship that they have. Because these three women in particular, they share experience that nobody else shares. The work that their husbands did, how they supported them, but also living through firebombings and protecting their children and the state of their mind of their children through all of this. Because you actually have a relationship with Merle Evers, so we'd love to hear more about how she just was so resilient through this and keeping up his legacy and developing her own legacy.
Yeah. And I'm trying to do my quick math. I mean, it was 13 children between the three of them. And the other thing that, of course, Dr. Betty Shabazz and Merle shared was actually watching their husbands die and their children being present in that occasion. And so the three of these women, because this is a love story on multiple levels, right? It's a love story between Medgar and Merle. That's the primary love story. But it's also a love story about girlfriends. I call them the group chat before there were group chats. Miss Betty, Miss Coretta, and Miss Merle, they vacationed together. And a lot of people don't realize, like, the sort of world tried to set them up as rivals. They would get invited to the same speaking events. They're like, let's have the widows come out. Yay, the widows. And they kind of set them up to be rivals, particularly with Coretta Scott King, who they tried to elevate as like the supreme widow, and the other two as sort of secondary widows. But rather than allow themselves to be separated and turned into rivals, they became buddies. They became good girlfriends. And all three of these women in their memoirs write about each other. And Dr. Betty Shabazz and Merle Evers Williams were particularly close. It is just a testament to their strength and to their openness that they became that. And, you know, I always remind folks that the premier, the sort of one who taught the other widows what to do, was Merle, because she was the one who was the first nationally known civil rights widow. There had been so many civil rights widows in the state of Mississippi and in Alabama and all throughout the South, because the Klan were just killing folks with abandon during that period. But she was the first one with a national profile. She was the first one to have CBS News and Dan Rather at her door when her husband was assassinated. Most of these women were anonymous and no one ever knew who they were, but everyone knew who she was. And she had to know how to look, how to sound, what makeup to wear, how to be on TV, how to speak on TV, how to give a national interview, how to tell her husband's story in a way only she could. She was the first builder of a Camelot before Jackie O had to do it for John F. Kennedy, or before Robert F. Kennedy's widow had to do it. And so she taught everyone else the template. And then that template could be used by Dr. Betty Shabazz, could be used by Coretta Scott King, could be used by Jackie O. And she did it so graciously.
Yes, she did. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this. And it's a beautiful love story and bringing us more closer to Medgar Evers as well as Merle Evers.
I always love talking about Miss Merle. She is one of my favorite people in the whole wide world. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to do that.
That was Tamara Payne in conversation with Joyanne Reed about her book, Medgar and Merle, Medgar Evers and the Love Story That Awakened America. It was published by Mariner Books in February 2024. This interview was recorded via Zoom on March 18th, 2024. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. Alani Hodge created our theme music. And until next time, thanks so much for listening. Have a great week.